Well, good morning, everybody. It's a beautiful day out there, and so part of me wants to thank you for taking time to come in here, and part of me thinks that you're pretty foolish to choose to be in here versus to be out there. But if you get to looking out the window at the sunshine halfway through and needing to dash away, we understand why. So I'll try not to do the same. although I suppose if I put you in small groups and disappear, you'll never notice.
In a teacher's dream, you have the ones with empty mind.
That's right. I want to talk a little bit about mining this morning, and I guess you read the description, so you know what's there. For those of you who haven't been in one of the sessions before, my name's John Jensen. I teach at Luther College, which is in Iowa, a long way from the Holden Mine and from the Pebble Mine that is proposed in Alaska. And my background is in ethics and environmental policy, so I want to talk about it sort of within the framework of what we should be doing, what the lessons are that we can learn from it along the way. And so my hope this morning is to kind of break things up a little bit. I'd like to talk just a little bit of some of the factual background, particularly related to the mine remediation in a very, very simplified form. I guess maybe it's Holden Mine Remediation for Dummies, and I'm the dummy, just to set up the conversation really about what we can learn and what some of the broader lessons are from there. I think folks in the village, for the most part, are rightly focused on, given the process, where it's going, how do we fit in, how can we nudge things in certain directions. But it also raises bigger questions about what should we learn. Does this process sort of work as we go forward? And then I'd like to take a forward-looking piece of it. One is to spend some time talking about what is, to the best of my knowledge, kind of on a national scale, the largest discussion that's taking place over a new mine in southeast Alaska, what's called the Pebble Mine. Again, a copper mine, although the geologists say it depends on what happens to the price of gold. It'll turn into a gold mine in a hurry, depending on what happens. And it's, as I understand it, is the largest known deposit of copper, gold, and molybdenum in North America that they know of. So a huge mine that's proposed up in that area relates to salmon very closely, for those of you who were at the session last night. And then to ask just a little bit at the very end, kind of more generally about issues related to mining. With developments largely driven by issues, concerns over environmental concerns and sustainability, there's a whole new generation of mining that's taking place, particularly with rare earth metals and in issues like lithium, etc. from there, that I think raises questions about mining and opposition to mining from there. But I thought we'd start just by talking about the Holden Mine just a little bit. Please feel free to interrupt as we go along or to add things in from there. This is a historical photo of the mill that was operational. As you look up there, you can still see the metal kind of infrastructure that would have been behind this, where the ore was processed and then the tailings were pumped out from there. My understanding is one of the things they are hoping to do yet this summer, but they're not sure if they'll get done actually, is to take down what's left of the mine, of the mill. That's there as part of the early stages of cleanup that's there. It's just fun, I think, to see the old photos. I'm not going to do much in terms of the graphics, but for those of you who maybe haven't been here before, some of you have been multiple times before, this is from the Forest Service, sort of showing the project location. Essentially, it's showing all of the Railroad Creek watershed. So from Lake Chelan, and those of us who came up on the bus, I'm not sure how else you would have got here. We come up along the road that comes up steeply from the creek and then follows all the way up to there. You can see here, so the dark spot here is Holden Village, up about 13 miles from the lake. The tailings piles here, although it's sometimes hard to see, there are three sort of distinct tailings piles that are out there. And part of the reason I think it's important to keep all of it in mind, well, two reasons. One is the impacts that they're talking about as part of the remediation are not just localized here, but also will affect other places along that valley. But also the big concern that's driving a lot of this is the pollution primarily in Railroad Creek from there. So what I'm going to do is turn off the computer and try on the whiteboard to be able to go in a very, very simplified manner try to be able to explain what's going on with the remediation and then talk about it from there. How many of you were at Chuck Carpenter's session on the remediation before? One, two. Okay, there'll be a little bit that is repeated from there, but most of what I want to talk about is not quite that. Is in a different sort of level of detail and comes at it from a different perspective, if you will. The mine operated for about 20 years, primarily mining copper at that time. The tailings that we see out here were pumped out in a liquid form. That were sort of pumped out from there and were sunk down in. There is a fair amount of heavy metals that are in amongst the tailings that are there, and it's coming out from there. So what I want to do is try to understand, to start with, what the problems are, then to understand what is in mind in terms of the remediation, again, and then sort of to back off to some larger questions that are there. In terms of the problems associated with this, again, it's been there since the 1950s, when the mine closed down, but some of it much longer than that. But we can really sort of break down the problems that are of concern into a few basic categories. There is an issue of air pollution. Some of you probably remember, because you've been coming to Holden for a number of years, that as I hear it told, that there used to be dust clouds that would rise up off the tailings and would sort of blow off from there. Back in the 70s and 80s, that was a fairly common thing. And some of you, I wasn't here then at the time, but my understanding was that was something that was of concern, and that would blow dust down the valley, and that when they did soil tests along the road down the valley and in there were detectable traces of certain types of pollutants that were there at the time.
Traces you could see beyond the leaves.
Okay. So you could see that dust that was there in a very visible way at other times from there. So one of the things that came in as an early remediation that was taken care of both back in, I believe, 89-90, is that they came in and they capped the tailings. So essentially they said, all right, we've got all this stuff blowing off the top. Let's put a layer in on top that holds that in place so it doesn't blow in quite the same way from there. We were walking down the other day. You can see sometimes off the side of the tailings piles a little bit of dust moving through, but it doesn't seem to be the same problem that was there. So that was one of the concerns, and still is one of the concerns that's out there. What happens as this stuff that is in that tailings gets kicked up in an air form? Another problem, I guess, is more in the realm of a potential problem that people are concerned about, is that there might be a slide risk. If you go out and look at Railroad Creek, it's pretty steep that comes down there. As I understand it from talking to some of the engineers that have studied that, it's not an if but when, that there is enough of a flood, some sort of seismic activity, enough of a rain event that goes on from there, that essentially you get one of those tailings piles that slides into the creek. And you can imagine if this is my creek and the water sort of comes here and the tailings go up pretty steeply there, what happens if I get a slide? It has the potential sort of to block the whole creek, to cause a major problem that they want to deal with from there. And so that causes problems for water. It causes problems sort of much beyond just the water, but I think the primary concern is what if you had a major slide into Railroad Creek from there. And then third, and I would say most seriously, is concerns over water pollution. That there are many test wells that are out there, and really what they're worried about is pollution both to the surface water in Railroad Creek and also pollution to the groundwater. So they have done dozens of test wells around in different places from there, and they've kind of mapped out the extent to which there is pollution in the groundwater, primarily of heavy metals that are out there. That pollution comes, so this is the impacts that are there. In terms of the sources, there are two different sources of that pollution as it comes out. One is coming from the mine portal itself. And again, up until this year, you had the possibility of hiking up towards the third level to where you could see the mine portal, and you just saw a small stream running out of that and along the ditch down along the road from there that was very colorful water as it came out of there. And my understanding is that given what was inside the mine, given the hydrologic pressure that's there. The way that I think of it is that the mine is sort of oozing out stuff from the inside in a slow level, but that is fairly toxic stuff that's coming out of the mine. It essentially is winding its way down and finding its way into the creek now if it doesn't soak into it before from there. And the second part of it is that water is leaching through the tailings. If we think of it again, if this is my tailings pile here, and then this is the creek down here from there, there's a certain amount as things rain, etc., of things just kind of moving their way horizontally through there, and what is in those tailings is finding its way both down into the groundwater but also into Railroad Creek from there. So those two different sources affecting the water pollution in different ways from there. And it's a couple of different things that are of concern here with the surface water that's there. Before I said partly there are heavy metals that are present in that water, but it's also what you can see if you get down there. There is, that's the sort of chemical component of it, but there also is a physical component of what people call ferrocrete. That essentially what is in those, what is in the water that's coming down from there coats all of the rocks with a concrete-like substance almost in a way that makes it very difficult for any sort of aquatic insects to attach themselves. And so what I understand from talking to the biologists is the creek out here in places going down from there from a kind of aquatic ecosystem point of view is essentially dead. Because you do not have the physical conditions that are right for insects to attach themselves, you lose fish and everything else because you've sort of taken the bottom of your food chain out of things from there. So it's not so much the chemical pollution as the actual physical changes that are caused by the coating of the rocks there that mean that that creek is not a healthy ecosystem from there. Now this is a fairly, and I'll get more into this, but this is a fairly limited impact geographically. So as I understand it, the heavy metals that are in Railroad Creek, even by the time you get down to the bottom of the tailings down in there, that water is still, the concentrations that we're looking at are sufficiently low that they do, that it still meets safe drinking water standards from there. I mean, if it's the old thing is that the solution to pollution is dilution, you have a tremendous amount of water that's flowing down. You have relatively small amounts of chemicals that are coming in at a slow release. So that water, I don't recommend drinking it. I think there's bacteria in there that could make you very, very sick. If the phrase explosive diarrhea means anything to you, then you don't really want. But that has nothing to do with the metals or the mining. That has to do with impacts in terms of the bacteria that can be in there from there. So I'm not saying drink it from there. But the ferrocrete does have a significant impact on the fish and on the other sort of life that's in there. But here again, by the time you get, as I understand it from the biologists, well before you get to Lake Chelan, and within 4 or 5 miles downstream from the tailings, essentially you have a healthy aquatic ecosystem again. So it is, although it's a significant impact here, that impact is not a long term, and there's no reason to think that it has any impact whatsoever on Lake Chelan downstream. Yeah.
Is there any thought that there might be heavy metals in ferrocrete or whatever sitting on the bottom of the creek and when you disturb the creek, you release all this?
Certainly, the ferrocrete is essentially, it's like they've painted it onto the rocks that's there.
So it would probably be okay.
That's a good question. I don't know how much of that stuff is sort of in the water and moving through and whether there's some of it that would be disturbed along the way. But certainly, I would think some of it probably gets disturbed when we go through from there. The plan, significantly, is, and I'll get into this in just a minute, is to move the creek. So essentially, you would be disturbing some of that, but most of what you're disturbing, I think, would go into the tailings piles in terms of the rock that is coated, et cetera, in there. But probably you do stir some of that up in the process, and it's a good question from there. Just a couple of the things I wanted to mention just related to this. There is the metals that we're talking about range from aluminum to lead to copper that's there, but the groundwater is significantly contaminated. I just wanted to be clear too. The village does not take its drinking water from groundwater wells anywhere around here, so there's no reason to think that there is a threat to any of us from the stuff that is in there. But there is contamination on this side of the creek. I mean, there are wells that are up the hill, et cetera, from here that clearly show contaminants within those groundwater wells, et cetera. So these are the problems essentially as they are out there in terms of what the concerns are and why we're interested in doing this. Does anybody have questions about any of that? I want to do the remediation and see if I can do it in less than 5 minutes. So a $150 million project that involves a dozen government agencies, but when it comes right down to it, what they're trying to do is pretty simple. And in many ways, what it does is it relates to the things that we're looking at here. And some of this will come back in a kind of reverse order. But one of the things that they will do kind of at the end is they will regrade and cap the tailings. So in terms of a slide risk, they will take out any of those sharp edges so that things will try to come back to sort of more of a natural slope going back again. You will no longer see these distinct tailings piles with the sharp edges on them, and they will no longer be as close to the creek that they'll try to anchor the bottom of it, but then take it back at a much more gradual slope over time. The idea is you take away your slide risk. If you can regrade things up from there, and by kind of regrading and then putting a cap of a gravel type over the top, you eliminate your air pollution over time. So in a sense, by bringing in a tremendous amount of large equipment that will kind of change the shape of those piles. They'll take down the infrastructure, they'll put a bunch of that stuff back into where the mill was from there, they'll try to cover it all up again. And it's as if you dug a big hole and then you tried to smooth it back out in your yard again from there. The water pollution piece of it is, again, as I said, that it comes from these two different sources. One of the things that they will do is they will cap the mine portal. And so they'll essentially, as I've heard it explained, it'll be a big concrete plug. I mean, it's as if you put a plug into a hole that's there, but because there is pressure coming in from behind, that they will also then capture the water that's coming out of it. So it's as if it's a big rubber stopper, except there'll be a hole in it in which they'll be capturing the water that's coming out of it so that they can then take it from there. And that they will ultimately treat that water. I'll get to that in just a minute. The other piece of it, remember, is that it's leaching through the tailings. So what they will do is they will build a barrier wall that is between the tailings and the creek. I'm going to say creeks because those barrier walls will come along Railroad Creek, but also will sort of wrap around the tailings up around Copper Creek as well. So if you can sort of picture, if this is Railroad Creek running along here, we've got lots of tailings piles that are sitting here and here. Well, in between them now comes Copper Creek, and then there's more tailings that come down this way. Well, they will put a barrier wall that will go along like this, and it'll kind of wrap up around this way, and another one that comes downstream like this. It's still an item of debate how far downstream that barrier wall will have to go. But essentially what they're going to do is come in, dig a huge trench down to bedrock. And somebody said before, it seems like it's all bedrock around, but basically get down to the point where the water cannot permeate through from there and put a concrete wall between the tailings all the way down to the bedrock in order to prevent that. So if water is flowing through here, it comes down and it hits up against that concrete wall and it can no longer get to the creek as a result of that. So they want to build that wall. Now those walls, my understanding is, will go from 40 feet below grade to get down to there, up to 100 or more feet below grade. So it's something that would be worth just coming to see in terms of how they're going to do it. I saw that on the west end of the dining hall, they've put up a bulletin board with some mine remediation stuff in there. They've got a picture on there that shows the excavator that will do some of this work next to what we think of as a standard large excavator, and you can see the size of the arm that is on that. It's worth taking a look toward it to see. My understanding is they will sort of simultaneously dig a trench and pump concrete down into it in order to be able to build that burial wall in order to be able to hold things. Then they will also, in the same way that they do it here, they will work to capture the water. Because so the water is coming down, hitting against that barrier wall, and it will be captured. And then all of this coming from the mine portal, etc., gets pumped down. And so the final piece of this sort of remediation is to treat the polluted water. So they will build a wastewater treatment plant that will be down past, if you saw where the new bridge is, downstream, basically down below the tailings, down where Railroad Creek goes by down there. They are building a new wastewater treatment plant, and what Chuck said the other day is the current plans call for that to be operational for the next 200 years. So they are capturing the polluted water, both out of the old mine portal, as well as the stuff that's coming through the tailings, and then that water will be treated.
How come they just didn't put a treatment plant in to start with? Just a treatment plant to take care of
it? Treatment plant.
On the creek.
Pardon?
Put it on Railroad Creek right at the end of the source and treat the stuff and just have a treatment plant.
Oh, I see. Treat the creek itself.
Yep.
There's a lot of water that comes down there, a lot.
Yeah, I mean, and so most of it is not that polluted as it comes through there, but I don't know. I guess it would be difficult, it seems to me, to kind of divert the creek and treat everything in the creek and then send it back down again from there, but I guess.
I'm sure they probably
still have your slide risk down below, which is going to cause water problems down below, so you got to down below the last of the slides, wouldn't you?
Plus, there's a lot less water to treat coming out of the tailings than come down the creek. A lot of the water coming down the creek is that you don't need to treat.
Right.
But you have to.
Right.
You
and we've had a flood that wiped out a bridge. Really worried.
Yeah.
In fact, that's why you can't walk all the rest way up the road when you head towards the ball field again.
Mm-hmm.
Go around where it cut off the bank.
Mm-hmm. Will you be talking about where the money comes from to pay for all this?
I sure can. I mean, in some ways, it's not. So none of this is, I mean, I shouldn't say none of it is public money, but the cleanup costs are all being paid by the mining company Rio Tinto. And so I can go into as much detail sort of as you want about the process that's involved. There are multiple government agencies that are there, but part of what is involved, this is governed under what we tend to think of as the Superfund law, or what's called CERCLA. Some of you may remember the story of Love Canal back from about 1980, this toxic site in the east where essentially there was a neighborhood and a school built on top of a toxic site from there. In response to that, our government tends to work in a very reactionary way. They passed a pretty comprehensive law to deal with polluted hazardous waste sites. Part of what's involved in that legislation is trying to identify what they call the responsible party. In this case, the mining company Rio Tinto, as I understand, the second largest mining company in the world, it's a big multinational, multi-billion-dollar company, acquired the liability for this mine, it's several steps removed from the folks that actually did the mining along the way, but it is involved in there. And they are voluntarily cooperating and saying that we will pay all of the costs associated with the mine cleanup from there. So the figure that's out there these days is $150 million for the cleanup that's there. When I say none of your tax dollars, there's a lot of government time that has gone into the studying, et cetera, of this over the last 20 years, really. So, I mean, some of that is. But this is a case where some people are really interested to say it does seem like the private side of things that ultimately benefited from the mining in some indirect way are also the ones that are paying for the cleanup.
How about the operation of the treatment plant for ever and ever?
Yeah.
I don't think they know who will do the operation of the treatment plant, but my understanding is that the mining companies, that's part of their responsibility as well. Whether there'll be some sort of settlement where they say, here's the money for operating the treatment plant.
Last week, the director told us, and they have a symposium here, that the mining company had budgeted for 80 years, so at least 80 years they'll be responsible for it.
Yep.
I mean, this goes on, the problem goes on till infinity, right? I
well,
mean,
no, it goes on.
Doesn't go
it goes
away.
On until it's all leached out of the mine, at which point they can put everything down. Nobody knows when that is exactly, that's why they picked 20.
It certainly goes on beyond the lifetime of any of us that are in this room. I mean, in that sense, I think is right. Yes?
Do they have a faint hope of reopening that mine someday?
No, my understanding is that they do believe that there is still a significant ore body that's in there. And what I heard again from Chuck is that it's actually the quality of that ore body is higher than lots of things that they mine now, but nobody seems to think that it is viable or advisable to reopen the mine and do it in that way. So I don't think that is in the plans in any way whatsoever.
Most of that mining is open pit these days.
That's
a
right.
A lot cheaper than digging into holes.
That's right. And
would Holton be able to use the wastewater?
Oh, for the village itself? I don't think so. I mean, I think it's far enough away and also a different enough type of wastewater treatment that it wouldn't apply. I mean, one of the things that Holton for the village itself is planning to do as part of this process is do a lot of rejuvenation of the physical plant of the village. And I don't know exactly where it stands, but I do think there's talk about a new wastewater treatment system. Whether that's in the current plans or not, I don't know from that. But.
Okay. Holden doesn't own this right here. We rent here, but don't we actually own the mine site? That's
we,
not why.
Yeah.
We own the patented, Holden Village, I mean, I guess it's we, right? We're all part of Holden Village in some sense, owns about 200 acres over there, and that includes a lot of the mine site, although certainly not all of where the tailings are, et cetera, from there. And so part of the concern always has been what's Holden's liability related to this? And
theoretically, we're liable too, but they determined that we didn't have the money to do anything.
Right.
Basically, what it amounted to.
Sometimes it's good to be poor.
That's right. Are there other questions about? I mean, and so it's not my intention to get into all of the details, but they're starting in on some of this work now. But they would do over the next 2 years very intensively work on these pieces of what's there, and then as we say, the water treatment plant is expected to be operational according to the federal documents that are there for 200 years. You're saying the mining company is budgeting for 80 years worth of operation from there, and what's there. What I want to ask is what we might learn from some of this, but yeah, go ahead.
Just a question on the treatment plant, how is it being powered? And if we look at if it's powered by diesel, some speculations is that the next 100 years, gasoline or petroleum is going to be very difficult to find.
Right.
So if we're powering it with diesel, then it's not going to be sustainable for 200 years.
My understanding, and again, some of you may know more of this than I do, is that a lot of the details related to the wastewater treatment plant are still being worked out from there, but that Holden has been pushing. One of Holden's things is sort of saying, okay, how do we nudge this process? How do we make sure it works? Is to look at upgrading the hydroelectric that could be could help the village, could help the remediation, but could also make sure that the wastewater treatment plant is powered by hydropower instead of by diesel. I don't know the details of that.
Okay. So everybody agrees that hydro is a better way to go because you can't get solar here. Diesel has its problems. But there's not enough water in Copper Creek to add more hydro. We use it all in the wintertime. So there are other potential sources, and they've crossed a few of those off, but they're currently looking at just taking Railroad Creek, which would be a low head but high volume generator.
Yep.
But again, you're on the edge of a wilderness area, so we got all kinds of Forest Service concerns and everything. It's not a slam dunk by any means, but it's the most logical way to do it.
Right. And at one point, there was talk of a second hydro on 10 Mile Creek. I think that's been eliminated.
Flow. They were going to get the flow from above the falls. And it turns out there's not a lot of water coming. Most of it's coming underground and out through there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions about the details of what we're doing? Or what we're doing makes me sound like I'm working for Rio Tinto or something, which I'm definitely not.
I think I heard somewhere, for people that are interested in the problem, you haven't discussed how we got to the problem, but I think I heard somewhere that originally there was, the mine did make a barrier between the creek and the tin piles, and the flood took that out?
Hmm.
No.
I'm not aware of that.
No, that configuration has pretty much been there since day one.
Okay.
There is, inside the tailings piles, there are sort of structures that were designed to hold them in place, sort of some wooden cribbing that is inside of things. So it's not just the tailings that's there, but how long that's going to last, and back to the sort of slide risk piece of it. So one of the questions that I wanted to ask, and I'll talk just a little bit about, but also want to set it up for you all to think about, that people have asked before, is it possible that the mine remediation actually does more harm than doing nothing whatsoever? And part of what I wanted to sort of try to lay this out for you is to say, the slide risk is one that's, I think, very hard to evaluate, particularly over the long term, but the water pollution, which the bulk of what is happening is actually geared towards that water pollution, is, in the standards of lots of things, not all that bad. As I said before, it's pretty limited geographically, and even the concentrations of heavy metals are not all that great that's out there. And so you have this major sort of job that's being done, and is it such a terrible thing to sort of leave things as they are from there? And thinking about that, what I'd like to be able to do is talk just a little bit about what are some of the costs and benefits of going through the remediation that's there, but then to ask you all and to say, is this, what do we learn in sort of thinking about this from a bigger picture? For those of you who were around on the very first session, we talked a little bit about using absolute rules versus kind of a calculation of outcomes from there. I think the law that we're talking about here, CERCLA, or the Superfund law, is very much based on a kind of rule-based, the polluter pays, we clean it up no matter what, and this is just what we do. How does that sort of bump up against a calculation of kind of costs and benefits from there? And so part of what I wanted to be able to talk just a little bit about is how we understand some of those costs and benefits. And I want to point out one more thing because it comes back to something. Part of this barrier wall involves a significant amount of moving creeks. So this is one of the things that they're hoping will still happen this summer. That if you were to go, if you walk the trail that is behind us between here and Railroad Creek, you'll start to see some flagging that is out there starting back roughly about straight behind us from here for about 1,500 feet downstream. They will dig a new bed and move Railroad Creek closer to Holden Village. And so part of what will be involved is trying to reroute that creek so you move it far enough away from the tailings pile so you have the ability to get in and build that barrier wall, and also to be able to in a sense, anchor things so it's not quite as close to the creek as what's there. So the two things that Chuck said are they're really hoping will happen this summer in order to be able to do this are to move the creek and to establish the quarry that will provide the rock for that new creek. And that's some of what is happening right now as they're looking at that, a site that is between Ten Mile Falls and Monkey Bear Falls. There will be a large rock quarry where they're mining rock out of there in order to be able to line both Railroad Creek where it's realigned and also Copper Creek where it's realigned, where they're looking for large rock up to 36 inches in diameter, in the sense that will go into the new creek bed from there. The guy that I talked to, who would be the superintendent of that quarry, said they're looking at 100,000 yards of rock that would come out of that quarry.
How will it impact that though?
Well, what are the costs and the benefits? One of the things that we know is that the impact of doing the remediation will not just be local. There will be what they expect to be, when it's done, a 10 to 15 acre site. He said they'll make it nice and level. It was fun to talk to the superintendent. Really, really interesting, nice guy. He said, you know, it'll be nice and flat, and you know, Holden could have a baseball field out there or something. So on your way to Monkey Bear Falls, you could stop and play a game of baseball. It'll sort of go up the hill and then sort of flatten out. And again, if you walk out there, you can see the flagging. Just putting the road in will be a major disruption from there. In addition, large amounts of sand and gravel that will be mined throughout the Railroad Creek Valley going down. They've identified multiple sites where they'll do that. Just thinking about the amount of concrete, the amount of gravel that it takes to cap everything from there. There will be a very large footprint in terms of areas that are impacted in order to just get the aggregates they're needed in order to do this.
But as far as the creek, it's not in the bed that nature intended for it. they've got old pictures that show the creek actually was quite a bit closer to the mountain before they started building the tailings piles. So the creek probably wants to get back where it used to be if they don't do something to really hold it in place.
But it's a good point that I think creeks move around. So the idea that we're going to build a new bed for the creek, well, the creeks sort of migrate in on their own and others from there. Other impacts of what we're looking at, just beginning to get a little taste of the amount of equipment that's coming in here. Thinking about the amount of energy, the number of carbon emissions that sort of go into the large picture of the mine remediation that is going on from there. Sort of thinking about all that's involved in the dirt work that's involved, the new bridge that goes in there, the amount that gets disturbed to put new roads in other places from there. Again, a large sort of footprint, at least in the short term from there. And we talked about air pollution before. I mean, they're one of the things that I know from talking to the folks that are involved in this, they'll do a tremendous amount of wetting things down to keep the dust down. And you might have seen that they did that on the road through town just yesterday. I think there'll be a lot of that is happening. Inevitably, still, you end up kicking up some of that dust in the process. And some people I've heard that have talked about this compared a little bit to the situation I think we found with asbestos in buildings. Sometimes you do more harm in removing it than you did by sort of leaving it in place from there. And so if the question is, might we do more harm in the remediation than in leaving things put? I mean, I want to ask you all two questions from there. One is to say, does that seem to you, as non-experts but sort of big picture thinkers, right, as a possibility that's there? And does that mean that it's a failure in our political system? Or is a system that is set up to make sure that we clean up our messes, that we identify those that are responsible, make sure they pay for it, which is the case here, is ultimately keeping that sort of system is what we want to have in place?
Well, I think the long-term benefits, I mean, if you have to think about not now, but 80 years from now, will my great-grandchildren, will they appreciate it more as we go through the short-term pain? And that's, I mean, that's part of what, you know, I think about. If this truly, truly works, then it's going to be wonderful. It's going to stop the groundwater pollution. It's going to stop a lot of things, and it might become even more pristine. Mm-hmm. But we have to go through a lot of pain to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that's a thought.
Good. So, I mean, one possibility is just to say, when we say that there's more harms than benefits, we're thinking about it in the short term. Yeah, we're going to tear up that hillside, but in the long term, we solve these problems. And it's the aesthetic piece that, you know, thinking about grandchildren, I think that hillside will look very different in 20 years than it looks now, and it should look much better, should have a positive impact from there. Yeah?
Yeah, I think also, though, you have to take into account the cost. So, you know, I don't see any problems with Rio Tinto paying $150 million, but maybe, you know, if they were, and there's probably no legal mechanism for this, but if they instead were to be able to pay 90% of that to deal with some starvation issues in Africa or mm-hmm. something like that, that just seems like that would be a lot more useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so this is the other side of it that we hadn't gotten to yet, which is to say, is this the best use of our resources, or would there be ways of doing things that still gets the polluter to pay, but does more good with the same amount of money being spent along the way? And I think there are analogs. I mean, with wetlands, this idea that you do wetlands mitigation in other places, perhaps, rather as a result of something. Exactly, or carbon credits. Yeah.
Well, the problem I have with that aspect, I mean, I like having... I'm not a big fan of laws, but the idea that if you screw it up, you're responsible
yep.
to clean it up. You know, not that you can, okay, well, let me buy my salvation over here. Let me do my penance or, you know, whatever.
Political
yeah.
indulgence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, political indulgence. I mean, I'd rather have, because if you know you screw it up, you're going to have to pay to clean it up, you might not screw it up in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so even if in this case, hey, maybe it's not exactly the right cost-benefit analysis, ultimately it's the sort of law that we want in place because, the big picture, this should help to prevent similar problems in the future.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
Well, this house sounds like a mess, wasn't it?
Yep.
And Rio Tinto is cleaning it up. Why, are they just the metallurgists? No, it's the minerals.
Right.
I don't mind that much.
Rio Tinto bought series of companies, and so they kind of bought a whole bunch of stuff at once, and this liability came with it. And
That's right.
So they do a lot of other stuff, but nothing from here, other than the PR.
Well, that's right.
And I think the PR is an important factor. I'm guessing that there's some place like, well, I don't know, Idaho or Montana, that they would like to build a mine. And so by being good citizens here, then they get a lot of, you know, they get a lot of points in their side for when they want to do it over there.
That's a good point.
Yes.
So what about like mountaintop removal in the on the eastern side? Are those companies just not in trouble because that hasn't been recognized as damaging enough?
Mm-hmm.
So
they've paid off enough politicians.
And they do remediation afterwards, but it's a sort of suburban wilderness.
Right, yeah. I mean, and so if those of you aren't familiar, it is a very common process in the Appalachians these days where they're doing coal mining, what's called mountaintop removal mining, where they're essentially, it's not exactly open pit because they're sort of just carving the top of mountains off to get to the coal and largely taking what comes out of there. I mean, so if it looks like this, they're largely carving off the top, dumping it into the valleys to get at the coal that is mined in there along the way. A very destructive process that is very controversial. And there are certainly lots of people attempting to do a better job of regulating what's involved, but it is a very political process, and it is, I don't think they've been very successful at this point in dealing with some of the issues that are involved. And
all
some,
those mine companies are doing it that way?
All of the mining? It's not something I know a lot about, but certainly it is the common practice in those areas. And that there's lots of coal mining in the Wyoming area that tends to serve the West, etc., and that tends to be more of open pit or sort of just kind of, in some cases, digging trenches in order to be able to get that out. But the stuff in the eastern part of the United States tends to be the mountaintop removal.
So is this company required by law to do this, or could they have just skated away from this?
Rio Tinto? So as Chris said before, Rio Tinto sort of acquired the liability for Holden Mine kind of through a series of transactions. And somebody once described, the best analogy that I've heard is in buying up companies, it's like going to a garage sale and you might buy a box of things because there's something on the top that you want, but you're not even sure exactly what is buried down in the bottom of the box. And my understanding is the liability for the Holden Mine sort of came along with some other things when they bought it. But this was the previous company that they had acquired had fought and fought and fought this along the way, and Rio Tinto essentially said, no, we want to cooperate and we want to make this happen. They are legally required, and they in order to do the cleanup, but they are essentially cooperating in the process in order to do it. And as people said, it's PR. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that for a large company, you're carrying this liability on your books. You don't really know how much that is, but when they started this process, even 10 years ago, they were estimating it at $70 million what the cost of that cleanup would be. It's now $150 million. My guess is it will grow beyond that.
So
I also think for the company.
Will this company pay for any cost overruns?
Pardon me?
Will this company be paying for cost overruns?
My understanding is they're willing to pay for it. There's still this dispute about how far down the creek the barrier wall will go, and part of that, I think, is how much is it going to cost as it gets further and further down to bedrock? Do the costs sort of balloon? And I think that will have to be worked out from there. But I do think if you're the company, if you say, okay, yeah, it's a lot of money, but what's a lot of money to us is not a lot of money to a big company, and you say it's a guaranteed amount of money now, or it's an uncertain liability 10 years from now that might turn out to be 10 times as much depending on where it comes out. I want to also ask some questions about sort of future mining operations and where all of this goes. And I do think it's something that all of us need to think about. You have a question about?
Very much what needs to be done is that in designing the mine and how you're going to operate, to figure out how you're going to close the thing gracefully, which generally has not been done.
Right.
Like the people there just dumping it in the river valley and saying that's good enough when it really isn't.
Right, although I think when you get permits for mines, you have to have in place sort of plans for what you're going to do. But
they're sort of wink, wink.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly a lot of regulation that goes on. Let me show you just a few images here and talk about another mine that is on the horizon, another copper mine that's out there. And again, sort of raising some of the questions. I think part of the lessons learned from the Holden Mine situation is that we often don't anticipate what the long-term impacts are going to be. We're not very good long-range thinkers. And so I think that's part of what's there. But thinking about what that looks like for the long-term piece of it. But I think for all of us as individuals as well, it's to sort of think about our own relationship to stuff. I just recently bought a new watch, but where does the stuff in my watch come from? As with lots of things in our society, a lot of it is petroleum-based, and we usually have a pretty good idea of where that comes from. But there are also are other types of minerals that are in there, and I think at some point, getting better at doing mine cleanup, but also sort of thinking back upstream from there. And so let me talk just a little bit about the proposed Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay, Alaska, and then we can come back to it. If you could see this, this shows a map. Alaska, the area that is in detail, is really down in this southeast corner from here. So Anchorage, it's about 150 miles from Anchorage that you can see up here. And in the Bristol Bay region in southeast Alaska. Inland here, this is the area that's there. What this shows, some satellite images where they've tried to put in place. This is what the area looks like now. It's definitely a wilderness. It's from all the images that you see, an absolutely beautiful area. What they're talking about, as I understand it, is the largest open pit mine in the world. And people are saying, and part of the reason folks are using satellite images to see is that you will be able to see this from space. That satellites in space, the scale of what we're talking about here is absolutely enormous. A large open pit mine, again, it's a huge ore deposit that is in there that they're interested in developing. But then the tailings ponds that are there, it's a tremendous amount of water. One of the biggest issues with mountaintop removal mining is the huge lagoons in which they put the water and the toxic water that's there. And one of the biggest impacts for locals in the areas is when they have those dams that break and there are floods that come down coming out of that. We're talking about tailings. I think the largest one they're projecting would be to 7 to 8 miles across. So the scale here is a little bit mind-boggling, I think. And the dams that would hold some of that back, again, I think it's all projected, but they're saying that this would be the dam on the largest tailings pile here, they're claiming would be the largest dam in the world. Larger than the Three Gorges Dam in China, if those of you are familiar with the scale of that. Some people saying 50 stories high would be the dam that they would eventually build in order to hold that back. And part of the concern is what happens if there is something that doesn't hold in that from there. A chance to get scale for those of you who are there, again, people that are working on it. This tries to put that site superimposed over the city of Seattle. So that you can kind of see, this is out into Puget Sound, Lake Washington, seeing where the pit is and the various tailings that are there, to see, again, a 5-mile scale on the bottom, a very, very large setup that's there. And when you can see some of the flat edges, those would be some of the dams that are holding back the liquid tailings. In terms of thinking about this, the big issue here that is driving a lot of this is salmon. This is the area, if I can step back upstream for just a minute, this area coming down in here, largely with the Nishigak and the Kvichak rivers, is seen as the most productive wild salmon fishery in the world. They're saying that the best count on the last salmon run is that there were 60 million sockeye salmon that came through this system in the last year. And very productive as a commercial fishery, hugely significant as a sport fishery as well. So the figure that I've read is roughly 40% of all of the wild caught salmon in North America comes out of this one system that's in there. And so very influential in terms of the native peoples that live in this area that have always been very salmon dependent. And for some of you who were at the talk yesterday on Snake River, it's partly given the declines in Pacific salmon in the Northwest. I think some fisheries biologists are particularly worried about what happens from there. Now, certainly the mining company is trying to say, we can do this without threatening the salmon fishery whatsoever. So I think that's hard. Yeah.
So just to be clear, the threat to the salmon fishery is the fact they're going to divert all the water from those rivers to make those? Because in that lower photograph on the right, you see the rivers coming into the tailing areas, whereas you don't on the top. So is that where the water is coming from? Is that those river basins?
Yeah, so my understanding is that so there's a tremendous amount of water that would be used in the mining operations. So they're saying, if I remember the figures right, 70 million gallons of water a day. And I think another figure was about 35 billion gallons of water per year. So just partly the water that would come in from there. I think the real concerns related to the salmon fishery would be some sort of a spill from the tailings. So that if you have, and there have been examples of this, there's one in Oregon that happened within the last few years on a much, much smaller scale where a tailings pond somehow overflowed or there was a break in a dam and it flooded part of a river and was just devastating to the fishery in that area. And given the scale of what we're talking about here, it is an active seismic area. So part of what is making people really concerned is, so I've got this 7-mile-wide tailings pond that is upstream from this salmon fishery, and we've got some sort of seismic activity. What happens downstream from there in terms of what could happen to the salmon fishery along the way? And people, are just worried, are scared more than they say, here's exactly what the problem is. But roads, spills, water, and sort of disrupting the cycle are what the real problem is, I think.
So they're proposing to create basically permanent toxic waste sites.
I think they would. I think folks would dispute the notion of permanent, but there is no plan. Essentially, what they're planning to do is to store the stuff there indefinitely, so that
like
it would
spend atomic rods if they have no place to go and so to try to pawn them off in Nevada or something.
Yeah, there's no other plan for sort of a permanent waste site somewhere else off site from where this would be. So in that sense, it is permanent storage on site.
There are estimates of the amount of material that's in this pit. I mean, is it going to be a 50-year mine, another 20-year mine?
No. I think at least 50 years, and I don't remember how many billions of dollars worth of ore that are in there, but they expect it to be a very long-term process. And I think part of what, to be fair, you're talking about is, it just takes a long time to get there. It's not as if you start your mine and 2 years later you've got a tailings pile this size, or a pond. It would be over decades that you sort of build it up to that point from there. Yes?
The other ethical issue is that we can legislate them out of this country and they go to the third world where they can get away with murder.
Right, yeah. So that's, to me, this is the question of this. So the Holden mine, long gone, we're figuring out what we should do, cleaning it up from there. But the real questions for us now is, what do we do going forward? This is a mine that is sort of in the early stages. There is not an official proposal for this mine. A large partnership, Pebble Limited Partnership, is a conglomeration of different mining companies. It's a little hard to get the details, but my understanding is Rio Tinto is one of the major investors in the Pebble Limited Partnership. Surprise, surprise. From there, they are operating very slowly. They claim to have spent $120 million on research studies as part of building up for this mine to try to show that they're doing due diligence.
Is that just lip service, or is it really doing it? Saying that they're doing it, I just spent $120 million.
I think they're studying it in depth, partly because that they know that they have to be able to have any hope of getting permits for this, and partly as part of it gets played out in the court of public opinion in addition to the permits that they would need from the state of Alaska, from the EPA and others from there. They expect that sometime within the next 2 years there will be an official application for permits to open this mine going forward. It is active right now that the Environmental Protection Agency did their own study of what the impacts of mining on the salmon fishery might be. That is open for public comment right now, that you could look into it and see from there. But I think your question is dead on, is to say, our tendency is to say, no, don't do that. This is a beautiful area. It's an important salmon-wise. We don't want you to mess that up. Well, what's the alternative? And I think this is something that we all need to sort of struggle with. The bulk of hard rock mining has been moved to the third world in recent decades. Not that we don't still do it here and there aren't sort of impacts from there, but mining companies are much more active in other parts of the world than they are here. Those places, as a general rule, do not have as strict a regulations as we do in the United States. Do we have a responsibility to keep our own mines, which are largely fueling our economy, within our own countries? Is there a sense in which it's a NIMBY, not in my backyard type phenomenon, in opposing something like the Pebble Mine? Or are there other alternatives that sort of push it back upstream to reevaluate our own needs for stuff, our own needs for having more and more minerals? Are there possibilities to do a better job of reclaiming and recycling the existing minerals that are out there so that we don't need as much new development?
Every time you upgrade your cell phone or computer, there's more copper.
That's right. Yeah, our electronics are very intensive in terms of the mining impacts of a lot of our electronics in terms of computers and cell phones, et cetera.
Well, do they know what they expect to take out of this mine? I mean, you say heavy metals, I mean, are you talking copper, gold, silver,
so, molybdenum? Yeah, copper, gold, and molybdenum are the three that I have heard. I suspect when you're talking about a mine of this scale that they might take other things on smaller scales as well. And my understanding is they're focusing on copper because of the kind of global markets. You know, the Holden mine was abandoned in 1957 because the price of copper plummeted. Copper is my understanding, is pretty profitable to mine right now, and so that they are taking things out from there. But gold, molybdenum. I mean, I have a molybdenum bicycle that I ride on a regular basis. Not that it's huge quantities, but we all use these minerals, and to be clear about our own complicity in the process.
For reference, you know, milk crate full of used copper pipe, Charlie took down and got $140 for it.
Yep. There's a good market for that, but we don't necessarily capture as much as we could. And there's people who've talked about mining landfills to get the minerals that are out of there.
I've actually been in Dillingham and I've worked on Michigan River. And it's quite small. And the Dillingham's huge. Wouldn't a lot of the fish be out of the Dillingham where, you know, you wouldn't have to worry about it? It seems like the Nishigat, it's really not that large.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, what I know is that sort of looking, that people are very interested in preserving this fishery as a whole, mm-hmm. and looking at those rivers particularly, but kind of exaggeration of the impact on the salmon fishery on these two particular rivers? Probably.
Yeah, I mean, you can see where Dillingham is and how the water goes.
Yeah, and it's a commercial fishery that people have talked about there, but I think it's not a huge number of people that are involved in some of that as well from there. Yep.
So we've had mines in the past where, for an example, where we store material on site and 50 years later we decide we need to build a treatment plant and deal with it. Why don't we put a treatment plant on here right from the get-go and process that water that's coming through there?
So the idea is to say one solution is instead of just storing it, build in your wastewater treatment from the very beginning so that you can, so that you can deal with it on site. I mean, I think it's the sort of thinking that's needed rather than saying, hey, here's the inexpensive way to do it. Does that make your mine, is that sufficiently expensive that it's no longer profitable to mine? I don't know, but I think it's a good suggestion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just mentioned that you did not update the how important the fishery was out of Birmingham. The Bristol Bay fishery is perhaps the largest salmon fishery in the world.
Yep.
It's huge quantities.
Yep. Yeah. So we said before that the figure that's thrown around is 60 million per year coming out from here. I want to ask. I don't want to get in the way of lunch, but let me ask one more big question, maybe just to leave you with this. I threw this up here if you want to know what copper goes for. It's still used primarily electrical in some of the stuff that's happening, but used in other places. And the question that I'm interested in is how we, what we can learn from something like the Holden Mine and sort of moving forward with this piece of it. Let me ask one more question here and leave you with this for lunchtime conversation. So that there is a lot of talk among some people that we need to apply what is often called the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle, much more common in Europe and influences a lot of environmental policy making in Europe, says that the burden of proof in terms of any harms is on the potential developer. So that it is the case that anybody who's developing this has to be able to show that there will be no significant harms from the work that they are doing. The way that I think of contrasting this is I think we've operated much more based on what I would call the progress principle, which is that we sort of jump into it from the beginning and we try to figure it out. And if anything, the burden of proof has fallen on opponents of any sort of development that's there. Show me why this isn't a good thing to do, because we've got progress that is sort of moving quickly in terms of how it goes forward from there. And trying to sort of step back to say we should go slow. We should be more cautious in what we're doing rather than assuming that the assumption here is that we will be able to solve the problems later.
Or that the problems are worth the trade-off.
Pardon?
Or that the problems are worth the trade-off.
Right, yeah. And that ultimately what we're interested in here more than anything else is the sort of economic development that comes out of it, rather than sort of prioritizing things a little bit more towards health. The claim of some people is to adopt a framework like the precautionary principle would effectively shut down our economy, because it would mean that we study everything to death, we never go forward with new projects whatsoever from there. But I think there is a feeling, and looking at some of these big cases, is we don't just need new laws, we need broader ways of thinking about things that help to go forward. And there's a sense in which I think that there is a built-in arrogance that has dominated our sense of progress and our way that we've moved forward, and that perhaps the biggest antidote is a much stronger sense of humility. And whether the precautionary principle ultimately is one way of getting at that, to say, well, we don't know exactly what it is, but we ought to try to understand to the best of our ability that there will be no significant harms, to appreciate the complexity of life that's involved, and have a different stance toward it rather than sort of moving in the direction of new things as quickly as we can. It's not hard rock mining, but the issues related to fracking of natural gas that are taking place in different places around the country and some of the newer concerns that are really coming up related to that, I think are another example of sort of leaping before we look instead of looking before we leap and really fully understanding that. So the question I guess that I would leave you with is something like the precautionary principle, a good way of thinking about things that might provide a new approach to issues like hard rock mining.
Yeah, and we sort of have a seminal form of that in environmental impact reports, statements that companies are supposed to fill out, and most do nowadays,
yep,
before they do a development. The problem is they tend to have no teeth and no responsible review, if you will.
Right.
And so, I mean, yeah, okay, here we submit this 14 reams of paper, and we're good to go now. And, you know, and so, I mean, that's part of the problem. It's part of the arrogance that, you know, well, fiscal progress, economic progress trumps everything else.
Yep.
So that's a change in our national demeanor.
Right. And part of what you're suggesting is taking environmental impact statements more seriously, giving them more teeth, might be one way of sort of operationalizing something like this. Yeah?
As an EIS writer, I take a little bit of issue with that. NHTSA requires that you just analyze and display the effects of a potential decision. It does not require that you do not have adverse effects. Mm-hmm. It requires informed decision making. And if the general public thinks that you didn't adequately display all the effects, they can take you to court and get that EIS redone. But if you say, yes, there's a risk, yes, I'm going to pollute the first 6 miles of the creek, et cetera, but it's worth it, and then going forward, mm-hmm. you've done the EIS correctly. Oh, you've met him.
Well, and that's what I mean, the review from the government agency that requires that EIS from you, they get it, and the company says, okay, here's all the information you want, and we're moving forward, and the government says, okay, we'll put this on the shelf, and you know, and then later when people end up with three-eyed frogs, then they look at that thing and say, oh yeah, they told us they were going to. You know, so I mean, it's not about the EIS.
Whatever the decision maker is, if it's on, if it's a mine on National Forest System land, there's a government decision maker that says, yeah, the world demand for copper, where this might go if we don't put it here, et cetera, might be worth the risk of three-eyed frogs and 4 miles of stream. I mean, they're making informed decisions, and the law permits that.
Well, I think the corporations doing those things are making perhaps informed decisions to their benefit. I think the government is sometimes quite lax in their oversight and response to that. I mean, California passed air pollution control regulations in the 1960s that we still haven't met today because corporations have sort of undermined every possible response to that. So that's where our government should be taking a more active role in making sure that, okay, on this particular thing, all those heavy metals and the impact on the stream beds and the water treatment plants and the diversion, that they actually look at that more carefully.
And it's not just the government, and it's not just others. I mean, I hope part of what comes out of this is a sense that all of us have a responsibility in thinking about our own usage, but also these are communal decisions that we have to make about where we're going to go going forward. And all of us have the ability to sort of be part of those discussions, et cetera. So thanks to all of you. I appreciate it. I'll stick around if there's other questions, et cetera, but I also realize some people may want to get to lunch.
I heard an environmentalist speak recently about mining, and his prediction is...